School starts in just a couple of weeks in North Carolina. No matter how districts across the state decide to reopen, the school year will look very different. I'm Anita Rao from WUNC in Durham. This is Back to School in North Carolina, a statewide special. So how are kids feeling about going back to school? What concerns do our state's teachers have about remote learning, returning to the classroom, or their own safety? How is the pandemic hitting school budgets? And what do education officials say about their plans? Public radio stations from the beaches to the mountains are joining together this hour for a look at the strategies to keep COVID-19 out of our classrooms. We'll hear from education officials, mental health experts, and others later in the hour. But first, a look through the eyes of teachers. In-person teaching, then no in-person teaching. North Carolina public school teachers had to prepare for both possibilities after school let out in June. And it hasn't been easy, as school districts across the state have flip-flopped between the two options. In Wilmington, WHQR's Rachel Keith checked in with some teachers about their fears of returning to the classroom during a pandemic.
As one teacher put it, it's been a whirlwind of plans. In early July, teachers in Wilmington, like others across the state, eagerly anticipated Governor Roy Cooper's announcement about school reopenings. Then the decision was delayed.
We want our children back in school safely, and we'll have an official announcement next week.
But when it was announced, it really wasn't a decision at all. Instead, the governor gave local school districts the option of opening under a hybrid plan, including both in-person and online classes, or a plan where instruction would take place only online. New Hanover County chose the hybrid plan, with students rotating through 1 week of in-person instruction and then 2 weeks online. That meant all teachers would have to return to the classroom, and some of them weren't happy.
We don't want to be a year from now completely upset and distraught going back into the building and not seeing five or four of our colleagues because we know that they had severe complications from COVID and either can't come back to work at all or that they've passed.
That's Amanda White. She's a high school chemistry teacher and she's the president of the New Hanover County chapter of the North Carolina Association of Educators. She didn't waste time airing her concerns about her colleagues who were in the high-risk category, including ones older than 65 or with a pre-existing health condition. And Amanda adds that just because she's not in a high-risk group doesn't mean she should have to teach in person.
They're going to force the younger, healthier teachers into the classrooms, putting them at risk, which is insulting.
Other teachers decided the risk was too great. Robert Turk retired officially August 1st of this year. He taught mainly high school math and calculus for 26 years.
I saw kind of the writing on the wall that I just didn't think that being in person to teach was going to be viable. Even if we started that way, there were going to be cases and we're going to shut down anyway. So I'm just like, I don't know if I want to do that.
Nathaniel Johnson, who's been an elementary educator for 23 years, knows what the virus is capable of.
It's really scary because I know of people who have personally who have had COVID. I know of a principal who died recently. And so those kinds of things always are in the back of our mind.
On top of that, there's the issue of masks and social distancing. When Governor Roy Cooper issued the mandate that all K-12 students would have to wear masks, that was something Robert Turk knew would be difficult.
I would have been like, wait, you have to put your mask back on. I mean, and that would have been happening probably all day long because I wouldn't have just let it go.
And there are other questions about in-person reopening, like how will temperatures be taken and who will take them? Amanda White says that many schools lack nurses and that teachers would have been the ones most likely doing the medical screenings and enforcement of social distancing and sanitizing protocols.
We have a nurse 2 to 3 days out of the week and she goes to other sites throughout the day. And so these are things where we're actually being put on the front line and we don't have any hazard pay.
Most everyone agrees that in-school instruction offers important emotional and social connections for students. But does that justify the risk? Robert Turk.
You're putting 10 kids in a classroom together, but we're like yelling at them if they get near each other. We're telling them they can't touch each other. We're telling them they can't share supplies. That's not the socialization that the students are used to.
Danielle Smallwood is in her 8th year teaching elementary school, and she has 2 young children, ages 4 months and 2 years old.
I am constantly trying to have pep talks with myself and just remain positive because that's the most important thing
we have to do for our students and our parents and each other.
With all the confusion this summer, patience will be critical.
This year will be like building an airplane as we're flying it. We have no idea what the school year is going to bring. Many of us are confused, and I know that we're not the only ones. I know that administration is confused and trying to make plans that will work.
And while teachers have always worn many hats, Nathaniel Johnson says this year is different.
We just need to be more sympathetic, especially because we have to deal with a whole lot of stuff. We become counselors, nurses, and sometimes surrogate parents. The public needs to be more understanding. This is totally different. It's a new norm.
13 days after New Hanover County Schools committed to a hybrid plan, the school board changed its mind, voting 6-1 to move instruction online for the first 9 weeks of school. To many teachers, this came as a relief, but they all say they will miss being with their students on campus. Here's Danielle Smallwood.
Of course, I'm going to miss watching them in their small group and laughing and having a good time. And it has taken me a really long time to understand that that might not happen this year. It's very emotional.
Emotional for everyone. Teachers, students, and families all across the state. Rachel Keith, WHQR News.
As some schools welcome students back during the pandemic, it's likely that the only healthcare provider on campus will be the school nurse. And in North Carolina, more than half of school nurses serve more than one school. BPR's Helen Chickering looks at how coronavirus duties will fit into their already overloaded schedules.
On a Tuesday afternoon in mid-July, members of the Henderson County School Board, standing 6 feet apart in the nearly empty school administration auditorium, faced the flag and, with right hands draped across chest, recited the Pledge of Allegiance. Kicking off what would turn out to be a more than four-hour meeting as the group, with input from educators, school officials, and the community, struggled to figure out the district's fall plan. The community watched online as board members read their comments and questions.
As the protocols in place mandate that high temperature or other symptoms of COVID be double-checked by a school nurse, will each school in the county have a dedicated school nurse this year? Or will we continue to split nurses among multiple schools, as is more typical?
There is no doubt in this COVID epidemic is going to absolutely really show how much we need a nurse in every school.
That's school nurse supervisor Kim Berry. She oversees the 17 nurses who serve the 23 schools in the Henderson County District, and who this fall, on top of their many responsibilities, will be on the front lines fighting to keep coronavirus out of the classrooms.
Obviously, there's a lot of discussion about how, you know, how you keep the areas separate, you know, routine care versus COVID, and how do you triage between, and what are the requirements for those rooms and ventilation. I know that's come up a lot. Obviously, PPE is a big conversation about, you know, how do you get it?
Guiding those conversations across the state is Ann Nichols, North Carolina's school nurse health consultant. Based in Raleigh, Nichols and her team host regular regional conference calls in an effort to help school nurses tackle the ever-growing list of coronavirus questions and concerns.
I mean, the common thread is anxiety, fear of the unknown, and that is a natural human response. Until we actually have entered a period when we have schools that have students in place, it really is hard to know what that might exactly look like. And in all your planning, sometimes you anticipate things, but maybe you don't anticipate them exactly how they work. That's just a part of life, not just a part of COVID-19.
Nichols says as the coronavirus wave made its way to North Carolina last spring, school nurses across the state stepped into action, working with local health departments on mitigation and response efforts, providing support to emergency feeding and child care programs, and offering input that helped shape the state's public health toolkit for K-12 schools. Now, as the first day of school, in class or online, draws near, nurses are focusing on things like training support staff and figuring out how to open online office hours for students who will stay home.
There is going to be no perfect system, and of course, there is no way to guarantee anything, but I do think that we are trying to address as much as possible, protecting school nurses and the people who are working in collaboration with them who are doing this frontline piece in the schools.
The state is providing 2 months' worth of PPE supplies for each school nurse and a support staff member. And while Nichols says she'd like to see North Carolina follow the recommendation by the National Association of School Nurses and have a nurse in every school, she has confidence in the nurses staffed on campuses across the state as they prepare to start a school year like no other. In Asheville, I'm Helen Chickering reporting.
Coming up after the break, Mike Collins from WFAE's Charlotte Talk sits down with State Superintendent Mark Johnson. And we'll talk money. Whether it's in person or online, how much is the school year going to cost? Carrie Brown from WFDD in Winston-Salem finds out. Our statewide back-to-school special continues in just a moment. Welcome back. I'm Anita Rao with our statewide public radio collaboration, Back to School in North Carolina. Families across the state are grappling with the realities of going back to school while the pandemic surges on. Options have been offered to each school district, and depending on what they decide is right for them, education will look a little different in various parts of the state. WFAE's Charlotte Talks host Mike Collins spoke with State Superintendent of Public Education Mark Johnson.
Superintendent Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me to have this important conversation.
This is going to be a very unusual school year for many students and teachers and parents, and a frightening one for some. The governor announced options for school districts to operate under reduced capacity or through remote learning or a combination of the two. How much flexibility do districts have around the state?
Well, it's going to be local control that makes the ultimate decisions of what returning to school looks like. But there is a cap on the flexibility. So we were able to work with the governor's office to eliminate the cap that was 50% occupancy. So that meant in a school, only half of the people who normally are there can be there. And instead that was changed to, in a school, you need to make sure at all times that all students and all staff and all teachers are at least 6 feet apart. And the most people you can fit into a school while keeping 6 feet apart, that's your max capacity. So there is a limit on how many people we can put in a school, but it's a little more flexible. And the reason that's important is when you're thinking about your big districts like Charlotte-Mecklenburg, Winston-Salem, Forsyth, Wake County, where Raleigh is, it's going to be much harder to get all your students into a school with that capacity. It is possible out east in our small districts, out west, and that is something they are striving to do with their in-person learning.
Well, whether you're a big district or a small district, you're requiring them to wear face masks for grades K through 12, fewer students in the classroom, things like that. Is it realistic to assume that that can be achieved either in classrooms or in lunchrooms or on school buses, that social distancing?
Well, you saw a disagreement between me and the governor on this, and I do support him ordering face coverings for everyone. I believe the science is becoming more and more clear that face coverings, at the very least, can help protect others if there's somebody who may potentially be spreading it and COVID-19 not even knowing. But that 6 feet, that's exactly right. That is extremely difficult. And there even is an exemption for school buses. On school buses, students will not be 6 feet apart. They will be wearing face coverings, but you'll be able to have one student in every seat because we just weren't able to get students to school if we only had, you know, 10 school students on a bus. When we get to the school building, it is required under the governor's health guidance. I was looking for a little more grace on that. I was hoping for some understanding that it's going to be very difficult for educators and principals to keep students 6 feet apart when they get off that bus, when they're in that hallway. It might be something where we should have had more grace.
Dr. Anthony Fauci has said he will not be flying in an airplane or eating inside a restaurant based on health and safety concerns. So if that is the case, why is it safe to send students and teachers and faculty and staff back into closed buildings whose ventilation systems are not always the most modern?
Well, I believe it is imperative that we get students back to in-person learning, but we also allow options for students and families who might not be comfortable yet returning, and teachers. So we've seen a lot of that around the state. For example, Charlotte and Wake County. I'm very grateful that's an option. I personally, for my seven-year-old who's starting second grade, I'd like to get her to in-person learning, even if it doesn't look like what it looked like last school year.
And what have you decided for your second grader?
Oh, well, we are in Wake County Public Schools, and they have decided to start under Plan C. So my second grader, just like many others around the state, even though I personally disagree with it, I respect the decision of the local health officials and the local superintendent and school board. She will be starting remote as well.
Plan C is all remote education, at least until the pandemic is over or its conditions change. The state health director, Mandy Cohen, mentioned that weighing the risks and the benefits played into the decision to move forward with in-person education with safety requirements in place. Weighing risks and benefits, that risk-benefit analysis, it seems to me, is something economists use to apply to business. These are children and children's lives. Is a risk-benefit analysis the right calculation?
I have personally not used a risk-benefit analysis. I am looking at how we now have strict guidance for face coverings and 6 feet social distancing. I do believe we can get students into classrooms with those strict guidelines, and we can have safe in-person learning. I would not ask any student, parent, or teacher to go into a situation that I didn't think was safe. And I've seen actually some summer school courses in session doing these restrictions, and it is possible. But we also have to weigh the fact that we not only have students for their mental health need to be back in the classroom, but we also have students who, you know, when it comes to the equity gap, we have students who don't have access to really high quality internet or don't have a device. We're working to close those gaps with federal funds, but those students, At the very least, I'd like to see those students be able to have the in-person opportunity, even if that means a very small number.
That is a significant challenge for a lot of young people, and that is a legitimate concern about those young people who do not have access to decent internet and do not have home environments that lend themselves to really learning or education. They may fall through the cracks. What did you learn from the spring when classes went virtual that can make the situation this fall better and more effective?
Oh, well, I appreciate that question, because in the spring, we had to switch to remote learning from 0% to 100% overnight. And we learned very quickly that as far as North Carolina is with using technology in the classroom, we were not ready for remote learning. And we've been very proactive over the summer. Some things parents will be happy to hear. We're putting out programs that, you know, the little things like not having to log in to a bunch of different apps to do different assignments, but also the big things from my own daughter's experience. Her part of remote learning that she actually enjoyed was when she had one-on-one time with her teacher, even if it was over video, or one-on-one time with small groups or her class. Even if it was over video, she still felt connected to her class. That's what we're setting up to have more of, even for the districts that are going to remote learning. And then we're supporting them with digital curriculum options that we've purchased with federal dollars to make sure all that's taken care of and the teachers can focus on the relationships with their students.
So have all the districts around the state been able to benefit from what you just talked about? Is the State Department of Public Instruction going to be sending out tips or even apps, or I'm not even sure what the technology would be, to help all these different districts accomplish what you say they can accomplish online?
Yes. So the way the federal funds worked specifically for schools, 90% of about the $400 million that North Carolina got went directly to school districts for them to use to buy the digital curriculum options that they wanted, to buy devices, to buy hotspots, to get students internet. North Carolina's Department of Public Instruction held back 10% of that, about $40 million, and that we're using to buy these digital options that every single district, whether you're, you know, the largest like Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and Wake, are the smallest like Jones County out east, you'll have access to use that digital curriculum
So all of that will be in place for the first day of school and the first weeks of school, and at least maybe in advance for teachers to understand how it works. All of that will be in place?
Yes, and very high quality professional development from the Department of Public Instruction to help teachers if they decide to use it.
So am I hearing you say that in areas where young people don't have good access or traditionally have not had good access to internet, they will have it now?
That is absolutely what we're working towards if a hotspot works. Now, you're reaching one of the hardest challenges that we had during remote learning is there are places in North Carolina, in the mountains and out in very rural eastern North Carolina, where even if we get them a hotspot, which we now have the funds to do and get them that connectivity, they still might not have that cell phone service. So what we've done there is we have given hotspots to districts that actually hook up to school buses, and the school buses can drive to certain locations where they work. But that still is a huge challenge for students because they've got to get to that location where that school bus is, and they may have to, you know, work out of a car. That's a huge challenge when you're already dealing with so many other challenges. And that is why for those rural eastern, western districts, we're really grateful for the local leaders who are making in-person learning possible.
There has been significant pressure from the White House on down to reopen schools here and across the country. Can you promise parents and teachers that the decisions being made by North Carolina are being made on the basis of science and public health?
Oh, 100%. These are local decisions right now. At the state agency, we have worked very hard to try to take as much of the burden off of local districts as we can with how we get the money, how we allot the money, with the guidance. We've really pushed to support local districts. But at the end of the day, everyone in North Carolina should know these decisions are being made by the local school leaders in consultation with state health officials. And that's why when you have 115 separate local school districts, you may have 115 different plans, but we acknowledge and appreciate how hard the local school leaders have been working to do what's right for their communities.
We're still finding out all kinds of things about this virus, and the CDC guidelines have changed occasionally. The latest ones on education and childcare have come down hard in favor of reopening the schools, but because children are, we are told, less likely than adults to spread the virus. But what about teachers and staff? I mean, I've heard from teachers who are literally, they say they are panicked. Those are their words. They live their lives. They feel that their lives are being put at risk by forcing them to go back into the classroom. We got an email from a teacher who said, how can we send teachers back to school like this, especially since they're not making any money? How can we let prisoners out of jails because of the virus, but we're sending kids back to school?
Well, the biggest thing that we've done, and this was working with the governor's office, was making sure that every district has the option for remote learning, even if they start sending people back to in-person school. So that means even if you're in Plan B, which means students are going into school, or even if guidance changes and you get to Plan A, there will always be a remote option for students, and we are encouraging that to be used for teachers as well. Just as there are teachers who are understandably afraid to go back in the classroom, and we respect that and we appreciate that, there are also teachers who are very anxious to get back in the classroom. And when you balance the two with remote learning, you can match the teachers who want to stay remote with the students who want to stay remote. And it's not easy, but nothing in this challenge and this crisis has been. And where there's a will, there is a way.
You were a teacher. Would you feel comfortable going back into the classroom in the fall?
Yes, I would. I do believe in teachers and principals. I've seen the amazing work that has gone on over the summer. And with the 6 feet separation, with the face coverings, I am confident that we will have safe environments for our students.
So the hope is that we return to normal sooner than later, and that at some point in this school year, the all clear will be given, and students and teachers and faculty and staff will be back in the school buildings. What metrics will be used to make that determination?
That is a question for the governor and for his health officials. We have been asking the same question as well, but we know that they are watching the number of cases and how quickly it is spreading in certain communities.
Are you worried at all about liability issues? If we go back in whatever form these districts decide to go back and suddenly something happens, should we be concerned about that as a state?
Yes, and we do have liability protections on the laws for teachers. We are actually pushing the federal government in the ongoing back and forth over what the next relief bill will be for even more liability protections for schools, because that is something that if we can get ahead of it, we should.
Mark Johnson, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As schools decide whether or not to hold class in person or online, one big question is at the root of it all. How much is this going to cost? The funding debate has been front and center from the federal level on down to state and local districts, each playing its own part in planning for the next school year. As WFDD's Carrie Brown reports, there are many challenges ahead to keep students learning and everyone safe.
At Sternberger Elementary School in Greensboro, this cafeteria is now a classroom. Chief Academic Officer Whitney Oakley shows how they made space for social distancing and desks.
These would be way too close together for kids to sit and eat lunch together in a cafeteria.
No carpet or fabric chairs are in this classroom, decorations are minimal, and no books or other shared supplies can be found. This is what it would look like under Governor Cooper's Plan B, a mix of in-person classes and remote learning. But this large urban district has scrapped that method for now. Instead, students will begin the first 9 weeks remotely.
No district in this country has the answers to this. It's just all too new, and we don't know where this virus is going. We don't even know if school is opening.
That's Superintendent Sharon Contreras. She says the district would need an estimated $100 million to fully reopen buildings. School leaders say they also worry about fluctuations in enrollment that could impact how much money the state allots to their district. More students equals more in their budget. What if headcounts shrink or enrollment surges when they do re-enter buildings? That's why local districts are pushing for the state legislature to hold school districts harmless. In other words, not penalizing them financially for enrollment changes.
Districts and schools could experience cuts in staff allotments and other funding tied to student enrollment if hold harmless provisions aren't made.
The state has sent PPE starter packs, providing a 2-month supply for nurses and staff to conduct health screenings. That includes thermometers, face masks, and gowns. There's been federal CARES Act money to help North Carolina during the pandemic. As of late July, more than $726 million has been allocated for K-12 public schools. But not all of it trickles directly down to districts. It's a complicated process. Several pots of money distributed to different departments. That can dictate how and when it's spent. Representative Jeffrey Elmore is a Republican who co-chairs the House Education Committee. He says there are so many unknowns that it's hard to plan what the cost will be.
We have to be very specific on seeing how the systems are handling it and what the needs are. And you just basically have to see that after they approach it with their plan and see where the shortcomings are.
Money issues are further compounded by how schools are funded in North Carolina. A landmark case known as Leandro found the state's model unconstitutional because it fails to ensure that every student receives a sound education. Shea Woodbury with the Winston-Salem Forsyth County School Board worries about the 7,000 students who didn't participate regularly in virtual learning last spring. Her district created teams on the ground to help reach these kids, something that also wasn't in their budget.
You have the issue of equity, that the children that depend on public school for more than just academics, but for, you know, a very familiar and safe environment that is dependable, those kids don't have that anymore.
Smaller rural school districts are also scrambling. Watauga County School Superintendent Scott Elliott says one of the biggest obstacles is broadband access. It's all going to come with a hefty price tag.
You don't have to get too far out of town to find yourself in a place with no cell phone service and no high-speed internet. And in a recent survey of our families, about 25% of them did not have access to high-speed internet in their homes because they couldn't afford it, or in many cases because it simply doesn't exist.
Todd Warren with the Guilford County Association of Educators is worried about the long term. He says many public schools are still lacking basic infrastructure needs like ventilation or enough classroom space.
We had educators retiring and not bringing in enough new educators. And right now we're watching a lot of educators deciding to take an early retirement rather than face the prospect of being, you know, close to 60 years old and going into a building that's not adequately resourced to keep them safe from a deadly disease.
Districts say if the pandemic drags on, they'll need a bailout as demands for more technology grow both inside and outside of the classroom. All they can do right now is to try their best to meet the needs of students, work with public health officials to monitor case trends, and prepare for a school year like no other. For WFDD, I'm Carrie Brown in Winston-Salem.
Coming up next, WUNC State of Things host Frank Stachow talks with a mental health expert about how children are coping. And we hear what college in North Carolina might look like for older students this fall. We'll return to Back to School in North Carolina, a statewide special, in just a moment. I'm Anita Rao with Back to School in North Carolina, a statewide special. We continue our conversation with a look at how families are coping with all the changes in store for the upcoming school year. WUNC's Frank Stachow talked to mental health expert Shauna Cooper from UNC Chapel Hill. They spoke about what families and community members can do to prepare.
What tips do you have for talking with kids about how this school year is going to go?
So there are various things that come to mind that I think are all important for parents, for family members, but also teachers to keep in mind as we approach the start of the school year. And I think the first place or the first tip that I often say is that parents should be as open as possible about the moment that we're in. Of course, they should do so in developmentally appropriate ways. So conversations with students who are in K through 5, middle and high school may sound different, but this is a stressful time. So even in the best of circumstances, the start of the school year is a time of anxiety and stress. So, of course, in this moment, kids are anxious. And so as much as possible, parents having an open communication about what's happening, as much as possible, what they can expect with the upcoming school year. So some of those things are still being decided. So I think it's harder for parents to say this is what the school year will look like. But having open communication around what might happen, what could happen, I think is really important for kids, regardless of age in this moment.
Well, I know parents have had to make some tough decisions when it comes to in-person versus virtual learning for their kids. Do you have any general advice about the anxiety around just making those decisions?
The answer is dependent upon a range of things. So, you know, the answer may look differently for one parent versus another parent. And I think what parents have been and are concerned about is making the right decisions, right? So what is the decision that will allow my child to continue to thrive, to continue to learn, to do well, to reduce their stress? So I think thinking about it in that way, also overlaying that with the decisions of school districts and schools, right? So I think that there's some school districts that have made decisions alternating days. Some districts are learning remotely entirely. And so I think parents, as they navigate those decisions, are thinking about ways to make sure whatever the decision is, that their child does well and remains engaged and isn't as stressed. So this is a stressful moment for us all. So it's hard to say that parents will alleviate all stress, but what are the things that they can do to help their children reduce anxiety and feel as comfortable as possible with things in the current moment?
What about there's certainly going to be some virtual instruction, I think, for just about everybody, but for a lot of kids there will be, and that means for parents who are staying home, figuring out a way to structure the day. Do you have any advice for that on that?
So routines are a big thing. And so, you know, what I would say is that establishing some routines are extremely helpful, not just for kids, for children and adolescents, but also for parents. And so when I think about routines, we think about it as only being associated with schoolwork. So what is the routine for the day to accomplish or get the schoolwork completed, for example. But I would also, as we talk about routines, think about it as, yes, the strategy for finishing schoolwork, but also a routine for taking breaks. So whether those breaks are meditation breaks or exercise breaks, breaks that allow not just children and adolescents and youth to, you know, de-stress, but also for family members and parents. Thinking about various ways that you can have a routine that includes both getting work done, but also stepping away so that when you re-engage or go back to the work, you can be more efficient.
You know, I know some older kids would be facing some unique challenges because they're going to miss some milestones like school dances, graduations, and FaceTime with their peers and just hanging out. So what can families do to try to replace all that?
So I think, you know, this goes to my first tip about open communication. And so I do think that it's difficult for parents to replace missing those milestones. Finding ways to not replace, but to celebrate these moments. And I think an important lesson for parents and kids is to really think about ways to celebrate these important moments, even if the way of celebration or method of celebration is not the one in which we had hoped, right? And so, for example, we have seen a number of parents, teachers, community members who have participated in drive-by birthday parties or drive-by celebration of key milestones for children. And, you know, I will also say even my retired parents have participated in a number of drive-by birthday parties for their younger relatives. So, you know, again, that's just one example, but thinking of ways to not replace, you can't 100% replace missing an event, but there are ways in this moment that we can be creative about showing kids, children, adolescents, and youth that we appreciate them, that we support them, and that we are celebrating with them in this moment that is, of course, less than ideal.
Yeah, and you talked about grandparents and others in this time. Is there anything that people without children can do to support their neighbors who might be struggling right now?
So I think that there are a range of things that might be helpful. So when I think about this moment and think about what's stressful, not just for children, but also parents, one way to support parents is finding ways to help support them in their roles as parents. So, for example, that could be helping out with planning a in-home learning activity or sending learning activity supplies, books to friends or family members that have children. I think parents are stressed managing multiple roles. So many parents are working from home, also helping their children learn remotely, managing their households. We also have a large number of parents who have been working outside of the home this entire time. And so their stresses are likely different, but thinking about ways that those who may not have children, who may be, you know, relatives or friends, can help alleviate some of that stress for parents as they help to make sure and ensure that their children are adjusting as well as they can during this moment.
We got a question about that stress from a listener. Lisa Sunshine in Guilford County wanted to know, what's the best way to reduce worry? I worry about going to school and getting sick and about not going to school and teaching effectively. So, you know, how effective can we be under all of this stress is Lisa's worry.
So I think the questions are really around ways to support teachers' mental health. You know, and generally thinking about broad ways to support mental health for those who are working with kids. And I think that question taps into many of the concerns. And so thinking about ways to support teachers is very, very multidimensional, right? So we can think about it in just, you know, providing support, emotional support, you know, supportive well-being, encouragement of self-care during these stressful moments. But I also think about ways, both in terms of sort of organizational ways that we can support teachers, So making sure, so this is more of a, from the perspective of school administrators as well as school districts, but being as clear as we can in communication. So teachers are managing a lot of things, right? So they're stressed about being effective educators. They're also stressed about the stresses of their students, knowing that, you know, every child that they're teaching in their classroom, there may be a range of other issues that might impact their learning at home. So teachers understandably are stressed about those issues. I think it's important to communicate to teachers and educators that we have to set realistic goals for what is happening in this moment. Teachers are balancing being effective educators, having a rigorous learning lesson plan, learning activities for their students, but also being engaging and then keeping their students motivated during a particularly stressful time. Teachers also have lives. So they have families of their own. They're managing learning of their children while they're teaching other children. They may have a family member who has lost a job or who has contracted COVID-19. So I think that as we think about ways to support teachers and educators in ways and strategies that will best support them in being effective educators in this moment.
Shauna Cooper is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you so much, Shauna.
Great. Thank you so much.
The first day of class for most UNC System schools is August 17th. Blue Ridge Public Radio's Lily Knepp spoke with a Western Carolina University student who already contracted COVID-19 as school officials set out new policies to address the pandemic.
Miranda Curtis is from Murphy. She's a hospitality and tourism major at Western Carolina University. Right now, she's rethinking that career path.
It seemed like a good major before all this started.
Curtis spent the summer working at Brio Tuscan Grill at Harris Cherokee Casino and taking online classes at Western while living in Cullowhee. About a month ago, she started having a constant headache. That's when she tested positive for COVID-19.
I couldn't breathe a lot. My friends would call me on the phone, and I just wouldn't be able to get a full sentence out because I was so out of breath.
She's okay now, but still isn't sure where she caught the coronavirus. Harris announced a COVID-19 outbreak in July, but Curtis thinks it could have happened during a night out in downtown Silva.
So I was having to do my online classes while I had the corona, but I'm going next semester. I'm just kind of worried.
Western Carolina students began moving into the dorms last weekend. There will be about 3,500 students in those dorms when classes start on August 17th.
Hi, I'm Kelly Brown, Chancellor at Western Carolina University. Together, we can prevent the spread of COVID-19 on our campus and in our community.
That's part of a video introducing the school's Catamounts Care program, which outlines some of the guidelines students are asked to follow, including wearing face coverings in public spaces and being physically distant when possible. The university is providing face coverings, hand sanitizer, and a thermometer for personal monitoring. Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, Sam Miller, says these new policies are difficult to implement in a space that's designed to bring students together, like a college campus.
The COVID-19 disease and prevention strategies really impact those experiences and make it more difficult to do peer-to-peer learning that is so very powerful and that students value so highly.
Like many UNC System campuses, students and staff were not tested for COVID-19 before returning to campus. Miller says the process would not have been effective because it only provides information at the moment of the test. COVID-19 tests are available on campus, and if students test positive, they will be asked to go home, says Miller.
We're going to ask students to go home, return to their permanent residence, and be with their family and be near their primary care physician to help take care of them.
If that's not possible, Madison Hall has been designated as an isolation dorm. All the rooms are now singles and have private bathrooms. Last week, there were over 6,000 COVID-19 cases associated with college campuses nationwide, according to the New York Times. Many were associated with summer athletic programs. 7 out of 145 athletes and staff at Western Carolina tested positive after summer training. Western is currently on track for over 12,000 enrolled students for this semester. Miller says that the majority of students come from Wake and Mecklenburg counties and the Western region near the campus. There are over 1,500 full-time faculty and staff at Western. Many have expressed concerns anonymously to BPR about hybrid instruction, which will teach students both online and in socially distanced classrooms. One person told BPR, "I'm definitely really scared. I wish I could quit, but a lot of places aren't hiring right now, so I'm going to stick with it and just keep myself as safe as possible." Mike Byers is the Vice Chancellor of Administration and Finance. He says the university is hiring the equivalent of about 25 new workers through temporary work and contracted services to clean facilities. Additionally, they're hiring an outside cleaning company which will sanitize any space where someone tests positive for COVID-19.
There's no way to do that with the existing level of staff. We're adding additional temporary housekeeping services to supplement everything in order to accomplish those extra duties.
Byers says it's now a requirement for all university employees to wear face coverings as part of their uniforms. There won't be any official enforcement for students. Byers hopes they'll self-regulate.
There's not going to be any kind of police that shows up and takes you away when you aren't wearing a face covering. But a faculty member can ask you to leave their class, and they could have anyway, and at any time. The faculty member gets to set the protocol for the classroom space.
Just over 50% of the workforce is back on campus. The rest are still working remotely. That will change as students move in and classes start. Sam Miller says that the Catamount community will need to take care of each other this semester.
Hopefully we'll make it to the end of the semester and celebrate, have a few chances to shout "Go Cats" along the way.
Classes at Western Carolina University start August 17th. I'm Lily Knapp, BPR News.
That's our look around the state at North Carolina's plans for the start of the school year. Thanks to our public radio partners, WFDD in Winston-Salem, WUNC in Durham, WFAE in Charlotte, WHQR in Wilmington, and Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Our producers are Amanda Magnus from WUNC and Wendy Herkey from WFAE. I'm Anita Rao, and this has been Back to School in North Carolina, a statewide special. Thanks for joining us.